So session three. The good news is there's only 30 sessions left. So session three is going to be, and again, you know, this is a survey class in its simplest form. This is not a deep study. This is not a Torah study in the sense of you. I know we're in Lorain County, but the sense that you know people that do Torah studies, I know Sandy does. And whereas in Torah study, you know, young men may spend their whole life just studying one chapter. They can spend weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks on each word or a verse. So this is just, but it's not meant to be that. It's not meant to be an in-depth study. It's meant to, I hope we started doing in the first two sessions, it's meant to be just kind of a explanation of what's in it and how it all points to Jesus, Yeshua, the Messiah. Because, you know, when he told the religious leaders, you search the scrolls and to look for eternal life and you do well, but all the scrolls are about me. Because everything is about him. And you know, people talk about how, well, you know, the Old Testament doesn't really tell us much about, well, it really tells you a lot. Like Friday night, I did a thing about the Holy Spirit in the Old Testament, part one. We went for like an hour and a half, and we got basically through like four books and all the references that refer to the Holy Spirit in the Hebrew. They refer to the word Ruach, which is spirit. And so there's, you know, God reveals himself, but we don't have any way to know that unless he reveals himself. In fact, even the very first verse, you know, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. The word God is Elohim, which is plural. The first book of Genesis, which we're in, is Bereshit in Hebrew. That means in the beginning. And so it's in the beginning, a God that's plural created the heavens and the earth. Not plural gods, but plural personalities. So that's pretty neat. And even in, you know, even the famous Shema, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. The word that's used for one, this Deuteronomy 6:4, the word that's used for one is Ashad, which means one like a group of, like a bunch of grapes. It's one that has parts. But today we're going to do something a couple things a little less profound. What's going to be Cain and Abel? We're also, believe it or not, going to do the flood. Because the main thing about this whole series is getting to Abraham and getting salvation history going. Because that's where the exciting stuff comes in. I mean, not that Cain and Abel aren't exciting. And not that the flood wasn't exciting, but, you know, Noah and Mrs. Noah and watching the Weather Channel and the whole thing's green and 10-day forecast, rain, 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 rain. Next 10-day forecast is rain, 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 rain. So we're going to start in Genesis 4 because now, you know, last time we talked about the fall and we talked about how God in Genesis 3:15 first proclaims the gospel that he is going to fix this problem now that's happened because of Adam and Eve's disobedience. He's going to put enmity between the serpent's seed and the woman's seed. So a redeemer is going to come. Because Adam and Eve are now contaminated and they can't fix their problem. We can't fix our own problem. Because we're going to see how contaminated everybody is. Even Noah, you know. You see, God says Noah's a righteous man, but he drank. He was drunk a lot of the time. Because he's a human, and you know, he could go down to 7-Eleven and buy beer while he was working on the ark. Then sometimes he'd call Mrs. Noah and say, make me a gin and tonic, would you? And she'd say, I don't know what that is. And say, oh, never mind. So Cain is important because he's the first human being born. Isn't that interesting? So Cain's the first person born. Remember, Adam and Eve are both cursed. And the earth is cursed. In fact, the whole universe is cursed. But Adam is cursed in that he's going to have to work for his food now. The days of walking around the garden and eating whatever you feel like eating are gone. And in the scope of salvation history, you know, God could not overlook the two of them taking a bite of an apple. And we're still contaminated by that. But yet people think they'll overlook. I mean, I've done 20 way worse things today than taking a bite of an apple. You know, people today think God overlooks everything. Oh, well, it doesn't matter. But he didn't overlook eating an apple. A bite of an apple. Not even the whole thing. And two animals died that day as the first blood sacrifice to make up for Adam and Eve's sin. Well, didn't make up for it. Their sin was covered by the blood of animals. And the thing to keep in mind, and that's the first kind of, after Genesis 3:15, that's kind of like the next proclamation of the gospel, because of their sin, an innocent victim dies. The animals in the garden had no sin. You know, just like later in the sacrificial system, when you took the lamb, when you committed a sin, you took the lamb had a throat cut, the blood got put on the altar, and your sin was atoned, was covered by the blood. And so the question is, you know, what did that lamb have to do with your sin? It's a lamb. It can't sin. It's morally neutral. It's just doing its part in creation, being a lamb. But one thing for sure is it had nothing to do with your sin, but it dies because of your sin. So two animals presumably died that day because of Adam and Eve. So, as you know, they're out of the garden. We're not going to get into all these details about the angel and the, you know, guarding the garden so you don't get back. I mean, these things are all very vague. We're not going to talk about the sons of God coming and having sex with women and producing these giants, and these are all kind of weird things. Nobody really understands them. So we're going to skip that. So don't tell your Jewish friends we're skipping around. They're the Nephilim, giant men. But we're not talking about giant men today. So let's go to Genesis 4 and just read I'll just read the first verse.
A man had relations with his wife, and she conceived and bore a son, saying, I have produced a man from the house of the Lord.
Isn't that neat? So Cain's the first person born, first human being born. Now, the curse that went on Eve was that she was going to bear children in pain. And that's applied to every single woman since Eve. You know, suppose there's painless labor if, you know, you have a C-section and you've been anesthetized. But if you have a baby normal way, I don't think too many women would say, I didn't feel a thing. So women have always given birth in pain. And I'm sure in Bethlehem that night, Mary was probably wailing and crying out. Eve brings forth this child, presumably in pain. And she names him Cain, which means my possession. I forgot what it is in Hebrew. So it's a possession. And interestingly, since Eve had heard, well, Eve was there when God talked to her and the serpent, and there was the promise of a redeemer. You know, I sometimes wonder, like, did Eve think, well, this was it. This was who God was talking about, was this baby I just had. Which, of course, it wasn't and wouldn't be, because Adam was his father. So it came from Adam's seed. So he's the first person born. But interestingly, she says, you know, with the help of the Lord, I produced a man. So imagine what that would be like. I mean, it's like they reproduced. I mean, that would be quite an astonishment. We don't know how long they'd been there, whether it was a year or a month or before they fell. It might have been 10 years. But now all of a sudden, there's another person. And I know, did they marry and this and that. They have lots of children. The girls aren't mentioned. The girls are never mentioned. And obviously, in the scope of things, she wasn't going to be pregnant. If she'd have delivered a baby and then they would have eaten the apple, what if the baby would have not eaten the apple? Because he would have been conceived when Adam was not a sinner. So he wouldn't have had the sin of Adam or original sin, or the, you know, he wouldn't have the Adam nature. So everything would be very confusing. Not to say he wouldn't have sinned later. And then that creates a whole other lot of confusion. So anyway, so Cain's born. And then go ahead and read the next verse.
Next, she bore his brother Abel. Abel became a keeper of flocks. And Cain, a tiller of the
soil. Now, Abel comes from the word for vanity. So, they're by possession and vanity. But Abel is the second son. We don't know if there's girls in between, and we don't know the space of time that goes. And yes, they would have had to reproduce with their sisters if they were the only humans. So we just get that question out of the way, because everybody goes, well, who did they marry, or who did they? And then after the first, you know, after the first wave, then it would have been cousins and, you know, nieces and nephews. I mean, it would have been, because DNA, there was no DNA mutation yet in humans until much later. Plus, how else are you going to make the race go? So later on, you know, when Cain gets banished, people say, well, you know, who was Cain's wife? I worded, you know, the gene. Then he meets some other woman from some, you know, Neanderthal tribe or something. But it's probably one of his sisters. So we don't know that. And it's not clear. No women are mentioned. Women aren't mentioned in the scripture. For, I mean, other than Eve, you know, they're not mentioned for quite a while. And you never find out that Adam and Eve had girls. Cain goes into agriculture. Not his father. Took over the old family business, but by then everything was named. But now they had to grow things, and they had to pull the weeds. They had to fertilize the stuff with manure. They had to water things. The days of wine and roses were over, where everything just grew beautifully. So now Adam had to sweat and work. So we don't exactly know what Adam was doing during all this. Whether he was working 9 to 5 in the field. But anyway, and he was home cooking. So he goes into farming. Abel becomes a herdsman. Now this is going to be important in how they do their offerings to God. So Cain works with agriculture, and Abel's a herdsman. Jesus even mentions Abel in Matthew 23:35. He calls him Abel the righteous. So Abel was clearly righteous, at least compared to Cain. Now they would have both been born with Adam's sin. Right? Just like we are. We're still, you know, the baby born right this minute somewhere is born with Adam's sin. You call it original sin or whatever you want to call it. It comes because of Adam and Eve. And Adam's the fountainhead of the human race, so it's always called the sin of Adam. But not to say Eve didn't do it. You know, and like we say when we do the Seder and when we do the Friday night Erev Shabbat, the woman always lights the candles. Because in Jewish thought, Eve brought darkness into the world. And so the woman lights the candles to make light, which I always thought was cool. So like Mary and Joseph, when it was Friday night at sundown, Mary would light the candles. She would say the prayer and go like this. we know that something else happens here, that there's going to be an offering to God. It doesn't tell us how this comes about. But somehow, there's this idea of worship that's going to happen. An offering is going to be made. Now, I would guess when these boys were grown, and these boys are not like 5 years old when this happens. You know, they're grown, and they have other siblings behind them. But we don't know whether, I mean, obviously Adam and Eve would have talked to them as they were growing up. You know, kids, we really had it made, but your mother blew it up. Your mother gave me that apple. And that's why I'm here sweating and trying to get bread. And that's why you hear your mother yelling when she's having your baby sister or whatever. So, and Adam, you know, was the spiritual head of the, quote, family, head of the garden. So we don't know if Adam would have been involved in this, probably, but there was some offering to God. So to make a long story short, their offerings are very different. Cain picks up some fruit off the ground and takes it to God. He says, here you go. Whereas Adam takes the first of the flock, the best, what it's called, you know. Yeah, the firstborn of the flock takes a good animal to be sacrificed. And, of course, this is also going to be about blood. But let's read a little bit about that. Start reading at 3. Okay, but pause there for a minute. So here's the thing. Offer the fruit, offer the animal. Now you got the impression, you know, Cain just offered some fruit because his offering was not acceptable. You know, later on when they offer the lambs in the, at the tent and in the temple, you can't take some sickly lamb there and say, well, we're not going to use this one anyway because it limps or it looks as sick. You know, this lamb's been sick since it was born, so this would be the time to get rid of it. And we can also do the sacrifice at the same time. No, you got to take the best one, no blemish. So you get the idea that, you know, Cain just picks a bunch of fruit or picks it up off the ground. So here you go. And it's kind of like people that say, well, it's Sunday, so I guess I should go to church. And you're just kind of picking up the fruit off the ground and going and sitting there going, okay, I went. You say to the Lord, you know, you should be happy I even came. There's a lot of other things I could have been doing. You know, people go, you know, you can't go to the cross and say, okay, I'm here. What else do you want from me? Well, he wants everything from you. He wants you to just show up and say, what else do you want from me? So you kind of get the impression, I think, that that's what Cain does, or is able to pick a good animal to take. So God looks kindly on that, doesn't like Cain's offering. So what's Cain's reaction? He gets mad. He gets mad at God. But you can kind of see in our time, you know, something bad happens to you, and you think, hey, why are you doing this to me? I've been to church every single Sunday for the past 2.5 years, and this is how you repay me? Fine, I'll stop going. You know, you get angry at God because something doesn't go the way you think it should go. Like, God should have let the fruit that had fallen on the ground and was all bruised up and half rotten. I brought something, didn't I? It's like, you know, the $5 bill in the envelope every Sunday or, you know, whatever. And I was a kid, we used to put in a dollar or two. But, you know, people made a lot less money. But you know, if you're making $100,000 a year and you're putting $3 a week in, here you go. That's like picking the fruit up off the ground. Here you go. Well, I gave something. Cain looks at this as, well, it's an obligation. I got to offer God something. And I said, it applies to us. Everything applies to us, too. Like, how many people, all my life I've been here, and it's Sunday, I got to go. And you say to people, if all I did was go to a mass once a week on Sunday morning, I would wither up. So I'm going to do something every day, all day long. Not, you know, I don't mean it that way, but you know what I mean. I mean, if you're going to be for the 57 minutes on Sunday morning, you say, oh, good, I went, then that's like picking up the bruised fruit. And the rest of the week, you don't do anything. So he gets angry at God. And because he gives the animal its number one, its best offering, you know, ancient, and we don't know when these people lived, we're not going to get into that. But, you know, ancient people, their livelihood depended on their animals. Their wealth was measured by how many animals they had. You know, Abraham, as we're going to see, you know, nobody knows about his IRA or his savings account or what his salary was when his father was making idols. But one thing is he had huge numbers of animals, and that was his wealth. Because, you know, if you got a couple hundred goats and a couple of hundred sheep, and you're a rich guy. So the thing, too, is this is going to prefigure the sacrifice of the Messiah, because there's blood is spilled when you offer the animal. So you say, I need to offer to God, I'm a sinner, and I stand condemned, and I've done horrible things, and I'm offering him as an animal as a sacrifice. So hopefully he'll accept the sacrifice of the animal's blood and not my blood. Substitutionary death. This is what, of course, Messiah does. Because when you took the lamb to the tent and later the temple, you put your hands on the animal's head and your sin was transferred to the animal. We're going to see when we get to Exodus. And the priest cut the animal's throat, collected the blood, sprinkled it. You're good to go. There's not enough lambs in Ohio to cover all the stuff I've done in a week, let alone all your life. And it has to be a perfect lamb, because this prefigures Jesus, prefigures Yeshua the Messiah. Because as your sins transferred to that lamb, all the sin of the world was placed on him. So these are all prefigurements. You know, like even the writer to the Hebrews says, you know, the blood of bulls and goats doesn't have any power to take away sin. It's a symbol. It's a symbol. That's why when you know the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross and you say, well, I get that, but I think all the stuff that led up to it was pretty interesting, too. So maybe I should start doing some of that animal sacrifice stuff, too. You know, just because, you know, it's in the Bible. You know, cover my bases or whatever. That would be ridiculous, right? I mean, if after the resurrection and the ascension, if Peter and John and those guys would have shown up at the temple with a lamb and said, I just want to, you know, atone for my sins, and it would make a mockery of the cross. Right? Or if you think you can be saved because you're not going to eat certain foods and you're going to light the candles at a certain time, you're not going to be saved by that law. So the blood offering is accepted. So it's a prefigurement. So Cain gets angry at God first, and then go ahead, read the next, start at verse 5. No, 6.
So the Lord said to Cain, why are you so grateful and crestfallen? If you do well, you can hold up your heart. But if not, sin is a demon lurking at the door. It urges towards you, yet you can be taken.
Okay, pause there. So that says, why are you angry? And see, he offers a way to come back, offers a second chance. You know, Jesus offers us a 99th chance and a 282nd chance and a 548th chance, however many times it is. It's not like one chance, you're screwed up, tough like bub. And like I said, you only know that says bub if you know the ancient languages. It could also be translated as you bozo. But yeah, that's right. The Greek word is bozo. The Hebrew word is bub. But see, here he says, why are you angry? If you do well, you'll be accepted. So in other words, next time, don't bring the rotten fruit that's on the ground. Bring something else. Or bring me the really good fruit and offer it to me and, you know, like you mean it. It's, you're offering something that's a sacrifice for you. Yes. That's right. There's no law yet. That's right. Paul says that until the law came, we didn't know what was sin. I mean, had general ideas, like, you know, you knew if you killed somebody, that wasn't good. You knew if you stole something, that wasn't good. But if there's no law, how do you know what a sin is? It's like if you go through a red light and you say, well, where I come from, we don't have red lights. You know, the cop says, well, tough. Here, if you got to stop at the red light. But if you don't have law, you say, why is this light here? Why should I stop? But yeah, that's a good point. But he says, you know, sin is going to always try to master you. Because that's our nature now. But you can fight it. You're not always going to win. But you're not always going to succumb either. So you have to resist. You know, the older translations say, you know, sin is crouching at your door. Which is really a great picture, you know. It's like everywhere you go, sin is crouching there. And, you know, some of it's demonic temptation and some of it is your own mind. And, you know, we have a defective nature. And like Paul says in Romans and Galatians, we did so many times, you know, your flesh always wants to be satisfied. Right? Always. I want to eat. I want to be satisfied. I want to do this. I want to do that. I'm going to go over there. I want her. I want him. I want this. I want that. I want the money. I want the job. I want the whatever it is. That's what your flesh is. Your spirit says, well, if God willing, I'll get the job. And, you know, maybe God will bless me with that job. And if I get that job, you know, I'm going to try to serve him the best I can while I'm doing the job. As opposed to, hey, I want that job because it's a good salary and I got a good. So is it sin's always going to try to master you? You know, a lot of people think, and this, you know, the men will understand this better than the women. People always think it's unreasonable that, you know, Orthodox Judaism, the men and women are separated. And Islam does that too. But when you think about it, the reason it's done is if there's a bunch of men praying and some women start walking by, the men are distracted. Am I right? People will, I mean, not that you're lusting and going, ooh, but it's a distraction compared to if other men walk by. So they separated them. You know, Jesus said, if you look at a woman with lust, you commit adultery without doing the act. And they said, well, so everybody goes, well, how, you know, what does that mean? You know, how far do you have to, and you get through all this, like, crazy thinking, what you're making your mind of it. But that was one way they tried to prevent that by, well, the women are over there and the men are over here. And we're so defective that, and, you know, lust is one thing, but whatever it is, you know, you can be in a group of, in a church of all people, you know, all men there, and you can still be sinning by thinking about, it doesn't have to be, there's no women here. I mean, you can be thinking about something else that is going to distract you and is going to be a violation of the law. And it's not necessarily just lust. But they tried the best they could to separate it all out. So now you have to try to master it. Well, does Cain say, "Oh, Lord, you know, I was such a jerk. I understand what you're telling me, and I'm sorry that I did what I did, and, you know, I'm gonna go home and, you know, I'm gonna pray about this and I'm gonna read the Bible." Oh no, wait a minute. I gotta say some prayers. I'm gonna go to church again on Sunday. Oh wait a minute. But next time I'm gonna bring an acceptable sacrifice. Does he do that? No. So let's read the next. Start reading at 8. Just read 8 first.
Cain said to his brother Abel, "Let us go out in the field." When they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him.
So instead of taking God's word of next time you can do this, he kills his brother. Because now his resentment, he resents God for what? Not accepting his sacrifice. Now he resents his brother because God accepted his sacrifice. Isn't that amazing? And it's like, you know, that would be like, you know, if you go to a family event and one of your cousins comes in and says, "Oh, I just got this great job and I'm going to be making $200,000 a year and you're making, you know, $50,000 a year." You say, "Oh, sure, he gets this big job. And I wonder who he knows over there." Instead of saying, "Oh, you know, I'm really happy in my heart that this guy has such a great job." You know, it's a resentment. We can't help it. And if you've, you know, like, you know, if you've raised kids, you see it even with really little kids. You know, how come he has that big truck and I just got like the little one, right? How come she has all those that stuff and I only have 2 dolls? They don't go on and on and on. You never have to teach a little kid how to lie. You never have to teach a little kid how to be selfish because it's the nature. So now he gets mad at his brother and doesn't just get mad at him. He kills him. First murder. Yeah, premeditated. Let's go out in the field and talk. I mean, isn't that sickening? He doesn't yell and scream at Abel and in a fit of rage kill him. No, let's go out in the field. You know, he kills him in cold blood. And interesting, too, I think it's interesting, too, that God says before this, he says, you know, how come you're sad looking? How come you're crestfallen? How come, you know, he knows, of course, our emotions and how we look and our facial expressions. You know, like in Psalm 139, it says, you know, before we form a word on our tongue, he knows it completely. And, you know, I always go back to the book of Ezekiel, where just before the temple's destroyed, the priests are worshiping idols in the basement of the temple. And the priests say to the prophets, "Well, we have them in the basement. You know, we worship God on the main floor, but now this, we do this in the basement, you know, because I can't see us here." I mean, how moronic is that? Yeah, like a little kid would do. Well, nobody can see me over here. But, you know, that's why Jesus, too, says, you know, the light came into the world, but men prefer the darkness because their deeds are evil. Well, what's the darkness? You know, if I'm doing an evil deed over there, I'm not going to do it in bright sunlight at noon. I'm going to do it after everything's dark and nobody can see me. But to God, what's the difference between the dark and the light? It's not like, oh, he's not going to see me if I do it at midnight. So he takes him out, and you get this impression like he lures him out. "Oh, can I talk to you for a minute? Let's go out to the field. I want to show you this tree." And he kills him. And we don't know if he tried to dispose of the body, if he tried burying him, or, you know, we don't know exactly what happened. But then this, you know, sometimes at the Seder we talk about the root of bitterness. You know, there's this root of bitterness that's started in Cain, and it showed itself finally by killing his brother. So instead of mastering the sin, he let it go to full fruition. And this is why Jesus says, you grow angry with your brother, it's the same as murder. People say, what? Well, first of all, both things violate the law. So you're condemned anyway. And secondly, you grow angry with your brother, and if it's a matter of you keep amplifying it, and the anger gets worse and worse and worse, till finally you say, okay, that's it. I've had it with you, and you attack him. Yeah, that's like the bitterness going to the extreme. 9 and 10.
Then the Lord asked him, where is your brother Abraham? He answered, I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper? And the Lord then said, what have you done with him? Your brother's blood cries out to you and the
Bible. Yeah, we've had 60 some million abortions just in this country. Talk about blood crying out from the ground. So, you know, what does this remind you of? God shows up and asks a question. Yes, Adam, where are you? Like he didn't know where Adam was. I know he's here somewhere. He's probably hiding in one of these bushes. I'll find him eventually. But you know, we, as sinners, God sometimes talks to you and says, where are you? And what have you done? It's very profound. But you know, he came to the garden and says, Adam, where are you? He comes here, he says, oh, hey, Cain, now where's your brother Abel? And you see the root of bitterness. Well, am I my brother's keeper? How am I supposed to know where he is? I wasn't hired to watch him. Can you imagine? At least Adam and Eve were scared. Cain wasn't even scared. Oh, am I my brother's keeper? So he says, what have you done? But I think this idea of blood cries out from the ground, it's really amazing. I mean, it's just really a powerful way to state it. But you've killed somebody. So there has to be justice for this. So, you know, this is kind of like, you know, his blood is crying out for justice. Probably not vengeance, but justice. We don't know. But soon God will institute capital punishment, as we're going to get when we turn the other page. So Cain is cursed. He goes to the land of Nod or something, gets a mark on his head so nobody kills him. We're not going to go into all that. There's at least all kinds of weird speculation. Who was going to kill him? He knew everybody. He knew everybody who lived on earth. Well, of course, they were Abel, but anyway, so Cain is cursed, but Cain also becomes the father of Enoch, and Enoch is a really holy guy. Enoch's one of the two people that never died, he and Elijah. So that's the first murder. So the question is, and then Adam and Eve have a son named Seth, which is called the good line. That's the line that ultimately Jesus comes from. It's a good line. But, you know, we did 1 and 2 Samuel here, so we know David was from that line, and he wasn't all that great. I mean, he's one of my heroes, but he wasn't exactly St. Francis. He was a wild man. But he was a man after God's own heart, and the Holy Spirit never departed from him. So we have here this idea of worship and sacrifice, and what does God accept? So there's some sacrifices God doesn't accept, and some that he does. we also see that now that sin's introduced into the human race, what can happen? That's been happening ever since. Right? And we have to try to, and you know, we have to try to, like he told Cain, we have to try to master that. We have to try to master that. Because if you give into it at every turn, what can it lead to? It just plants this root of bitterness and then it grows. And you go from quietly not being able to stand somebody to saying, hey, look, if he's coming, I'm not going to be here. Or meet the guy outside and say, hey, since you're here, let me tell you something. And hopefully not going further than that. Okay, now we're going to do Noah and the flood in rapid form. This is kind of like the cliff notes. So why does the flood come? Woo. So we're going to Genesis 6 now. And in my translation, it's entitled The Wickedness of Mankind. So let's go down to verse 9 and start reading. First read 6:6. Anyway, Genesis 6:6.
And the Lord desired that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart.
Now, why was he sorry? Read verse 5. Read verse 5.
The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thought of his heart was full of evil continually.
So man only thought about evil continually. So God says, why am I even dealing with this? You know, there's so many times, or even like when we talk about the people in the wilderness, you know, God says, you know what? I think I'm going to destroy everybody and just start over again with you, Moses. Remember all that? And Moses says, well, wait a minute. You know, Moses always intercedes and says, but wait a minute. These are your people. You took us out of Egypt. You can't kill us here now. So here it's like everybody's constantly thinking about evil. Kind of like a dark, immoral free-for-all. Everybody's just thinking about themselves. And, you know, Paul writes to Timothy many, many centuries, you know, centuries and centuries later, and says, you know, a time's going to come when people's love will grow cold. They won't care about anything except themselves. They don't care about their parents. They weren't going to follow any rules. They're just going to do whatever they feel like doing. You could say we're living there, except for the, you know, the remnant. And then most people who feel that way generally wouldn't go to a Bible study on Sunday night, but but it could be just a cover. I know somebody in here. I know somebody's rotten in it. It's me. I can't remember who it was. I wish I could remember. There was a saint. I can't remember his name, but let's say it was Bob. Just to make it simple, it said that he started off every day saying a prayer that went along the lines of, Lord, watch out for Bob today because he'll turn on you every chance he gets. That cracked me up when I first heard it. I can't remember who it was. And I can't confirm it's really true. It sounded cute. But we all get that idea. And I think, you know, it's, you know, in Ecclesiastes, it says there's nothing new under the sun. I mean, people have always been, you know, whatever happens today, you're going to find it's happened. But, I think in our time, with all the comfort and the stuff that we have, it's even gotten harder to master sin, and it's gotten harder to follow, and it's gotten harder to be serious because comfort overrules everything. And I don't want to do that now. I just want to relax and watch TV and go to sleep. Or I know there's people out there that don't have anything to eat, but I'm kind of hungry now, so tough luck for them. You know, I mean, I'll do that. I'll do that. So here's the solution, verses 7 and 8.
So the Lord said, I will blot out man, whom I have created from the face of the grass, man and beast, and the creeping things, and the birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have sinned. The Lord contemplated on the life of the
Lord. So God's solution is, I'm just going to kill everything. And it's not just the people. It's even the animals. It's even the creeping things. I mean, this is a, God doesn't get angry like we get angry. This is God's wrath. This is what the people deserve. This is what people deserve. But I'm not sure why the animals and everything on the earth deserve it, because after all, you know, they're kind of, animals are just playing their part in creation. They're not, what's the term? Yeah, they don't have, so there's this guy, Noah, who's, you know, he's working at the Ford plant, he's living in his little house, but God loves him because he's righteous. He finds a righteous man. Remember when Sodom and Gomorrah are about to be destroyed? Well, what if you find 10 righteous men? What if you find, well, obviously there weren't that many because the place got torched. Pretty badly, I might add. And in, you know, in today's tolerance, you know, everybody thinks the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah was lack of hospitality. Yeah, that cracks me up. Yeah, lack of hospitality. So, you see, in verse eight, it says, "But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord." You know, somebody read 9 and 10. Yeah. So Noah's upright in character. He finds favor with God, and he's somehow righteous. Doesn't really tell us how he lives, but he's an ordinary guy. An ordinary guy. There's a little house. Probably, and doesn't live anywhere near a body of water. So he starts building a boat. He looks pretty ridiculous. Dude, what are you doing? I'm building a big ship. Are you going to tow it to the ocean? So, you know, he's going to destroy all flesh, man and animal, and actually everything on the earth. But he finds a righteous man, Noah in Hebrew. There's going to be one of the first covenants on here, which is kind of cute. So we got Abraham while walking on covenants. So start reading at 11.
Good.
Okay, positive. So he finds this righteous guy and says, you're going to escape the punishment. Everybody else is going to die. But you, Mrs. Noah, your sons and their wives are going to be saved because you're going to go into an ark. It's an ark of gopher wood. I don't know exactly what gopher wood is. I always mean to look it up, but I don't know if anybody knows. Oh, okay. Good, then I don't have to look it up. So he cut down a bunch of gopher trees. So it gives the specific measurements. And you remember, a cubit is the distance from your elbow to the tip of your third finger. So, of course, it's going to vary from person to person. But in this case, we'll assume it's Noah's arm. And you'll know when God gives the instructions for building the sanctuary and the ark and everything. He gives specific instructions of how many cubits everything is, what kind of wood, you know, the ark's acacia wood, and then there's gold that's hammered onto it and plated it, and the poles they use to carry it are also acacia wood, but then they're all covered with beaten gold. So you have this beautiful golden image with wood inside. Here he tells them exactly how big the ship is going to be to fit all these animals. Could they have all fit? I don't know. Have any of you been to the place in Kentucky that has the ark? Yeah. It's kind of interesting. But it's built to these specifications. It's pretty big. I'm not sure you'd get two of every animal in it, but it's pretty big. Like the elephants and the giraffes might be an issue. You know. Plus the perennial question, what the Belions eat. Oops, there goes the antelopes. They were vegetarians, exactly. Yes, well, they were. We're going to see that after the flood, things change. As well as lifespan gets a lot shorter. A lot shorter. If we're to believe that, you know, Methuselah, who was Noah's 969, he was Noah's grandfather and great-grandfather, and Adam was 949, and then all of a sudden you went to, like, you know, 40. I mean, if you think about it, if Adam really lived 949 years, man, he would see, like, a huge chunk of human history. Plus, everybody would say, you know, this Adam lives over there in that second house on the cul-de-sac. Really? The Adam? So he builds this huge ship out of gopher wood, puts pitch in it, and God says, I'm going to bring a flood on the earth, but I'm going to make a covenant with you. Now, the Bible is a book of covenants. There's two main covenants, Old Covenant, New Covenant. And there's all kind of covenants that go through both of those. Well, especially the Old Covenant has lots of, you know, subheadings of covenants. A covenant is not like a contract. It's not just an agreement. It's a very intimate exchange of persons. When you make a covenant with somebody, you're bound to them. It's a binding. We'll get into that one. And one way, the closest thing we have in human experience to a covenant is marriage. And the difference between a covenant and a contract is the difference between a marriage and a prostitute. You make a contract with a prostitute. You say, okay, here's the deal. Or, you know, another example, if somebody comes and is going to remodel your kitchen, you say, I have all the material, you just have to come and do it. And he says, okay, it's going to, my labor is going to be $50 an hour. So you keep track of how many hours the guy worked, and then at the end, you pay him that X times 50. That's a contract. A covenant is much more intimate. It's exchange, actually, of persons. It's exchange of love and devotion. And you know, God says, I'll be your God and you'll be my people if you keep this covenant. You know, the church is the bride of Christ. God calls Israel his bride. That's why Israel is always referred to as a harlot when she does idolatry. Because she's cheating on her husband. And so Jeremiah gets told, Israel's such a harlot now that she can't even hide it. You know, she's committing adultery under every tree and in every field. She's waiting. This is one of my favorite verses. She's waiting on the road and will go with any lover who comes along. It's a really stinging rebuke. So, you know, you have the true God. I have this covenant with you. But somebody comes along and says, oh, we have this other God, too, who's pretty cool. And you say, okay, well, I'll check it out. You know, God looks at that as adultery as well as idolatry. But anyway, so he's going to make a covenant with Noah and the family, basically. So he builds the ark, and he works a long time on this. He works actually 120 years. I mean, how many trips to Home Depot? Come back with some more gopher wood. Pound in the nails. Unless he had a nail gun, but probably not. Oh, yeah, they had to order it. He's trying to buy it online. I'm going to need a lot of gopher wood delivered. Just put it in the backyard. So he builds this huge ship. Now, you can imagine during this time, something's going on, like the neighbor saying, what's he doing over there? I mean, there's no ships around here. We're nowhere near an ocean. What's all that hammering and sawing over there? And doesn't this guy ever have to like, go to work or something? Why is he always out there building? I mean, he would face ridicule, but he still did the thing. You know, as Christians, we face ridicule for what we believe day to day. I mean, day to day. So all this time, and you know how, and you know, interestingly, Jesus said, you know, what's it going to be like when the Son of Man comes? It's going to be like the time of Noah. Remember he says that? So what was the time of Noah? Human heart was always set on evil. All this dark stuff, all this horrible stuff. It's time to get rid of everything. Right? It's going to be just like the time of Noah. So he refers back to this. Now sure, you know, you probably heard every culture has a legend about a flood. That's probably because it's true. Probably because it's true. Even the New World, are you still allowed to say Indians? No. Native Americans. Even people in the New World, Indian tribes had legends about a great flood. So this kind of trickled down through human history, probably because it was true. And if it wasn't true, if there was no Noah, Jesus said, well, you know, it's going to be just like the time of Noah. It's like what people talk about, well, was there really an Adam and Eve? I say, well, Jesus talked about Adam quite a bit. Oh, there's not really a hell? Well, that's interesting. Because he talks about hell a lot. 4 times more than he talks about heaven. So, all this time he's building and doing, society goes on. You know, Jesus says it will be just like the time of Noah. People will be getting married, given in marriage, going to work, you know, taking the bus downtown, cooking their meals, you know, building a house, taking the kids to soccer. So for all those years, life just went on until the rain started. Now, had they had the Weather Channel, I don't know. And I don't think it, It doesn't specifically say that Noah really warned. Did Noah warn people a flood was coming? But then God tells Noah, get into the ark, you and your household. For I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. And then he even has to take, he has to take seven pairs of the clean animals. In other words, there's no dietary law yet. But you look down on verse 2 of 7. Take with you seven pairs of all clean animals, the male and his mate, and a pair of the animals that are not clean, the male and his mate, and seven pairs of the birds of the air, also male and female, to keep their kind alive upon the face of the earth. So some animals had more than just a pair. So the clean animals, you know, you're going to see when the flood's over, Noah does a sacrifice. So there has to be extra animals. Or else if he kills one of the two. You know, you've probably seen the cartoon about the two unicorns standing on the shore and the one says, oh, crap, was that today? Yeah. So then the flood, you know, you notice it's not just raining. It says he opens up floods from in the earth. So there's like water coming from above and there's water coming from below. So for 40 days and 40 nights, that's a lot of water. And he's like floating along. And probably thinking, like, how much food did Mrs. Noah pack before we left? That's right. Do you have any of those chips left? I'm going to get a donut out of here. Oh, no. So that's pretty neat. So all this time. So when the flood came, Noah was 600 years old. So when it ends and the water recedes, then we see the covenant, which we can think of. It's always brought to our mind pretty often over the course of every year. And that is the rainbow. Somebody start reading at 17.
Maintained their crest over the earth for 150 days. And then God remembered Noah and all the animals, the wild and tame, that were with him in the ark. So God made a wind sweep over the earth, and the waters began to subside. The fountains of the abyss and the floodgates of the sky were closed, and the downpour in the sky was held back. Gradually, the waters receded from the earth. At the end of 150 days, the waters had so diminished that in the seventh month and the 17th day of the month, the ark came to rest on the mountain.
So 150 days, and then you could start to see the tops of the mountains. That's a lot of water. Even if you had just gotten a new roof, your house was going to be gone. So So everything's dead except what's in the ark. And something else too, since we were talking about wood. You know, the earth was full of sin and all these, everybody just had evil set in their heart. So in a wooden structure, God saves a few people. Doesn't change them from being sinners, but saves them from what's going on in the earth. As opposed to the wood of the cross, that changes, it can change everybody who comes to it. And not only save them, you know, not necessarily save them physically, but save them from sin and change their heart. Isn't that cool? Wood. And Peter talks about the ark. I was got First and Second Peter mixed up. But doesn't Peter talk about the ark on the water as representing baptism? Or I think it was something else. Yeah. So all this time, it takes a long time, obviously, for the water to recede. So now let's go down to verse 20, chapter 8. So that's kind of another indication that this actually did happen. Peter talks about it, inspired by the Holy Spirit, of course. Start reading at 8:20. Never again am I going to destroy everything on the earth. And no matter what people do, no matter what a bunch of horrible sinners they are, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm not going to do this again. And so as long as the earth lasts, there's going to be seasons. Planting, harvesting, winter, you know, the weather seasons. The earth is going to still go on in its cycles. I'm never going to do this again. To destroy everything. So, you know, you get the impression like, you know, is God regretting what he did? Well, you know, to us it seems like he's regretting it. But, you know, we don't know. We can't comment on his emotions. So let's go there. Let's do start in 9:12. The Noahic covenant. It's called the Noahic covenant, the covenant with Noah, even though it's actually the covenant between God and all living things, that water's never going to destroy the earth again. So in case God forgets what he promised, when he sees the rainbow, he remembers it. Now, the rainbow's for our purposes, not his. Although, poetically, he says, oh, when I see the bow, then I'll remember the covenant. But he's not going to forget. You guys are a tough audience. Usually that gets a lot of laughs. So like when we see a rainbow, I mean, I didn't know that until probably 1995, but, you know, I changed my whole thinking about rainbows. I don't just say, oh, cool, look at the rainbow. I said, wow, God's never going to destroy the earth by water again. It'll be fire next time, but it won't be water. Well, he calls it a bow. So there's two other things that happen after the flood. Because, of course, now the whole earth has to be repopulated. Now, Noah and Mrs. Noah are, you know, 600 years old, so I don't know how much repopulating they... But, yeah, but the sons and their wives who are... They're probably a mere 200. Yeah, they had wives. So they're going to go and repopulate the earth. So actually, you know, you got Adam and Eve, like, nobody knows what the population of the earth was when the flood came. I mean, it couldn't have been like 5 billion, I wouldn't think. I mean, we don't know how much time goes by. And then along with this covenant about the water, two other things happen. Animals now will eat other animals. And now there'll be capital punishment. And now we're also allowed to eat animals. Before this, humans only ate fruits and vegetables and grains. Remember in the garden, he tells Adam and Eve to eat the seed-bearing fruits and the plants. And we see in chapter 9, look at verse 3, every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. As I gave you green plants, I give you everything. Only you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, the blood. So you can't eat meat with blood still in it. And that's, of course, one of the dietary laws. Very important. In fact, even at the First Council of Jerusalem, where, you know, they got together and said, what are we going to do with all these Gentiles? You know, do they have a will? Because they had Judaizers telling them they had to follow the law, and what are we going to do with these Gentiles? And whoever thought Gentiles would be coming and one of the things they said was, don't eat blood with the meat still in it. So Jews hang the meat up until all the blood drains out of it before they'll eat it. Because life is in the blood. And this is another, that verse, although this is long before the law, and Noah has no idea what Messiah is going to do, has no idea what Messiah is going to be like. I didn't find that out until after he died. You get this idea that life is in the blood. And this is why blood sacrifices what's needed. Because when you sin, you sacrifice your life. And life is in the blood. So either, you know, without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sin. So either you have to shed your blood because of what you've done. In other words, you're going to be condemned. Or there's a blood sacrifice in your place. So here he says, life is in the blood. Don't eat meat with the blood still in it. But now you can eat animals. Everything that's on the earth you can eat. He's going to change that later. But it was hard. You know, it was kind of hard. Like, we look back on things 2,000 years. But if you're Peter and those guys and you're living this in real time, and all your life you've been keeping the dietary law, and now all of a sudden it's, well, you can eat whatever you want. I mean, you would be like, what do you mean I can eat whatever, you know, it would take a while to get used to that. It would take a while to get used to that. Like in Acts 10 when they go to Cornelius' house, you know, they're walking to Cornelius' house, and they're probably thinking, I wonder what kind of refreshments they're going to have. We've never been to a Gentile prayer group before. You know, what if they have shrimp and what if they have the little scallops with the bacon wrapped around it? That's violating the law times two. So you can eat anything, and in verse 5, for your life's blood, I will surely require a reckoning. Of every beast, I will require it, and of man, of every man's brother, I will require the life of a man. Whoever sheds the blood of a man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image. So in other words, capital punishment is instituted at the same time as you can eat the animals now. You can kill animals, and once you drain the blood, you can eat them.
And you can't kill people
because they're made in God's image. So if you kill somebody, then your life is required.